This is Madeline Fisher, and I'm interviewing Dr. Mara McDonald, who is an assistant administrator in genetics at the UW-Madison, and today is January 17th, 2004. Okay, so we'll start with your childhood and schooling. So where and when were you born, Mara?
I was born overseas in Frankfurt, Germany in 1947. My parents had met during World War II. Used to refer to it as just the war, but we've had so many since that it was the World War II. My father was a medic in the army. My mother was a nurse in the Italian army, and they met in Naples when, according to one side, the Americans were liberating the Italians, and according to another side, the Italians were being overrun by Americans. So anyway, they married, and my father did some work in the army again in the reconstruction of Germany.
Can I interrupt? Did they marry then in Europe somewhere?
They married in Trieste, in Italy.
Yeah. Okay.
My father actually was married and had to return to the States to divorce his first wife because there had been some problems, and had decided to marry my mother. So he went, as he was being sent back to Germany, he had 3 days to marry her. And he arrived in Trieste, and my aunt had told my grandmother, who's wasn't terribly knowledgeable about things, but my father was part Cherokee, and my aunt had told her to expect an Indian in full headdress coming to the door. So my grandmother was shaking in her boots, but she really liked my father. And so my parents spent about 2 years in Germany, and I was born, and then my father decided to come back to the States, to his state of Texas, and start a business with a friend that he knew from the army. And they went to this little panhandle town called Childress, Texas. So my mother had gone from the first 2 years of her marriage, she had a butler and a nanny for me and a maid and whatever, and she went from this sort of luxury, life of luxury, to a little town in Texas where there were dust storms every day, and the business actually failed, so it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And she had my sister at that time too, so she had quite an extreme experience in her first few years of marriage to my father. He re-enlisted into the army for a couple of years because of the financial burden of trying to get back on his feet. We lived in San Antonio, and then we moved to Fort Worth, where he was originally from. He had done a newspaper column in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram before the war, and was well known, very well liked. He was working three jobs, as I recall, when we were small, just trying to make ends meet. And when he got a promotion and had free time to spend with family, then he was killed in a car accident. Mm-hmm. So it was a fairly tragic. I was seven, my sister was six. Mm-hmm. And it was a time when we were just feeling like we were getting into being a true family, and mm-hmm. Things changed around. Mm-hmm. My mother remarried a few years later, and my stepfather had parents who still owned a farm, and so we spent 2 or 3 years spending a whole lot of time on the farm, riding a horse that my stepfather had bought for us that hated children but loved music. And she tried My stepfather's family was very musical, and they would get together on Sundays and bring out the fiddle and the piano and the saxophone or clarinet and whatever, and they would sing and play music. And the horse just got so infatuated, she tried getting into the living room one day. But she hated us. We were always getting dumped. But it was a lot of fun. It was a great place. The Chisholm Trail went across it, and you could still find artifacts from some of the old wagon trains. Mm. And there were Indian arrowheads all over the place. Mm. My cousin was a collector of them. And it was just a wonderful laid back life.
Mm-hmm.
Have really fond memories of it.
Mm.
Then my parents moved. My mother and stepfather were going to school at that point and decided that what they really wanted to do is to study anthropology in Mexico City because it has such a wonderful group of people there. And we moved to Mexico City for about 10 months, I think.
And how old were you then?
I was 12. I had just turned 12.
So did you go to school there?
Yeah. There was a school run by an American woman who was down there, and she set up the school so that Mexican children would learn English.
Mm.
So the school was set up where everyone in the first grade spoke English. Everything was, all the instruction was in English. And then in the second grade, in order to meet the requirements of the Mexican government to provide a certain amount of education for the first 6 years for everyone, everyone started first grade Spanish classes and second grade English classes. So it was divided up like that. And I was in seventh grade English, sixth grade Spanish, and the sixth grade Spanish was just a whole lot harder.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because we were studying history and the perspective of what was important in the history of the Americas was very different in Mexico than it is in the U.S. As a matter of fact, I don't recall that the U.S. was mentioned very much at all. It was mostly about Cortez and a lot of the armies of liberation through South America. So it was very interesting. But my parents hadn't really calculated how much it would cost to live in Mexico City, and there were money problems, so they decided to come back early.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved to California then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in California when I was ready to go to college, and my parents felt that the school that I needed to go to had to be a state school where it wasn't very expensive, so
mm-hmm.
it was UCLA, where the tuition then was about $50 a semester, and books for science courses were all hardback and maybe about 100 pounds of books, but they were less than $20. So it was unusual to even have a paperback book
mm-hmm.
in those days. And it was, even though it was a big school, it was a very good education, I think.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about UCLA now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess I did, in high school, I did some volunteer work with a friend at the Neuropsych Institute.
Uh-huh.
And this was basically a business set up by a young graduate student in his mother-in-law's garage in Altadena, California. And he was making student brain research kits, or kits where individuals studying physiological psychology could do some experiments using the stereotaxic and putting electrodes into rat brains and doing some histology on it. And we were also doing some experiments, and we were learning histology and learning some electrical theory.
And you were doing this in his garage?
In his garage.
And so what interested you, and why were you interested in getting involved in that?
Well, when I was 7, I was interested, I saw an open heart heart surgery on television. This was in the 50s, so it was 55, and it was the beginning of households having televisions, and there was a program on heart surgery, and I became very, very interested in it and decided I wanted to be a physician. So in high school, I and another friend who was interested in science decided it would be a good idea to get some experience in science, which would help us get into the fields that we wanted to go into. So we looked around, and there was this advertisement in our high school about this institute. We both signed up and volunteered. She stayed
and
about
this was a year. Neuropsych.
This was the Neuropsych Institute. It was great fun. We both signed up. She went for about a year. I think I stayed 2 years. And then when I went to UCLA, it turns out that this person's name was James Skinner, and he was doing graduate work at the Brain Research Institute, and they needed a lab assistant. So I got a job in the BRI for about 2.5 years.
BRI?
A Brain Research Institute,
okay.
At UCLA.
Okay. And that was while you were doing your undergrad?
Mm-hmm, okay. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I was more interested in working there because I had more personal interaction than in studying. So my first couple of years of school were not as well spent as they might have been. But I did have some good experience. Mm-hmm. And although I just stayed there 2.5 years, it allowed me to move on to other part-time jobs at UCLA that were somewhat interesting.
Mm-hmm. Let's stop for just mm-hmm. a second. So, Mara, your main interest then in science came from your desire to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. That was why, that was your idea. Mm-hmm. That was what you wanted to do. Is that
That's
correct?
What I thought I did.
Okay.
And so I was somewhat of a pre-med major.
Okay. And so how did you end up choosing psychology as a major?
Well, I was fairly naive going into college, and I didn't have any real good counselor, I guess. And I wanted to study biology, but at UCLA at the time, the biology department was divided into zoology and botany, and I didn't think that I wanted to become a zookeeper, which is what I thought zoology would train me for. So I chose psychology because I was interested in psychobiology, the evolution of learning, the study of behavior intrigued me. And I thought that I could use that as a major and a focal point, continuing my work in the Brain Research Institute, and that I would take the required pre-med courses while I was going through the curriculum. It was shortly after I declared psychology that it occurred to me, or someone told me, that zoology was the major I should have declared, but they said it was just really, really difficult. So instead of being required to take all the courses.
Who was this person who said this?
I think it was one of my roommates who was in zoology. I mean, it was an enlightenment. I decided not to declare zoology at that time, mm-hmm. but I did take most of the requirements for the major. Other than cell biology and the second semester of physics, I think.
And you decided not to declare zoology. Why?
Because I thought it was going to be far too hard to take. So
okay.
I You know, but by the end of my senior year, I realized it would have been just right up my alley in terms of my interest, and I should have declared it. It's poorly counseled.
So are there are some courses or instructors that stand out in your mind, and then for what reasons?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have several of them. Mildred Mathias was a botany professor who was retired mm-hmm. out of UCLA but still taught the plants of the Western Hemisphere. And she would take us out on field trips and then talk about the different characteristics of plants. And we basically had to learn over 100 families of plants mm-hmm. Found in the Western Hemisphere, largely tropical ones. She was just an incredible woman because she was just so energetic and just so loved her work and, you know, just was imbued with this passion for her work. And I actually have heard her about 10 or 15 years ago on the radio being interviewed, and she was still as energetic mm-hmm. and passionate. There was an individual in the psychology department that really turned me on to the evolution of learning, and that was Frank Krasny, who actually was my employer later on when I was a senior. And he was looking at what level does learning occur, and he was using crayfish as his model organism and trying to teach them habituation. And trying to show that crayfish do habituate to stimuli, and that he was able to show that there were neuronal changes mm-hmm. associated with this. And this was way back in the 60s, so it was remarkable work. But I remember going in after finals in my senior year, and we needed to complete an experiment. And the experiment consisted of having a crayfish attached to a cork with various recording devices on its tail, and I needed to plunk it, and it would give a tail flip response, mm-hmm. which was an escape response, and I needed to do that for about 20 times once every 5 minutes. Well, this was at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was sitting there going, I hate crayfish, I hate habituation. I just want to go home. But we did get the experiment done, and it was really interesting because Frank had studied in England, I think probably at Cambridge, and he introduced us to a lot of the ethological literature from Europe, which was focused on the evolution of behavior, whereas in the American School of Psychology, they were just interested in rats and flatworms, platyhelminthes. You know, if you teach a flatworm to run a maze and then grind it up and feed it to its little fellow flatworm, does that flatworm take in molecules that are important in learning and learn to run that maze? I mean, this was a huge discussion. I mean, it really got ugly too because people were doing it. They were doing experiments where they would teach a rat a particular experiment or a particular behavior. Take the rat, grind up its brain, and feed it to other rats, and determine whether those rats actually performed the behavior without any training and did so statistically more than they would normally do that than the control rats. And there were all kinds of problems with it, talking about blood-brain barriers to chemicals. They thought that the RNA molecule was important for memory. And and it probably is at this point if you stop to think about how RNA molecules are turned over in cells, they probably have something really important to do with memory. But it was just an ugly discussion, although extremely interesting.
Any other instructors or courses that stand out?
I had a Western civics instructor who was very much interested in art, and so he would talk about a period of history, and then at the end of that period give a slideshow on the art associated with that period, and it was just excellent.
Mm-hmm.
I had an invertebrate zoology professor that was the first person who took me into the field. I remember standing waist deep in mud flats looking for organisms, you know, wondering how I was going to get out, but it was a lot of fun. I had a calculus professor that, although I always say I like calculus so much I took it twice, I actually got a D in it the first time mm-hmm. and had to retake it, or wanted to retake it, and this particular individual was just so stimulating that I thought that I might even consider going into math as a although I quickly learned that calculus was not for me. And then I had a couple of ecology professors in zoology, Martin Cody and Jim Brown, who really showed me what field biology was all about, and it was wonderful.
Mm.
And I really got the bug and decided that I wasn't going to get into medical school because I didn't have the GPA, and I realized, I think late in my junior year that I didn't have the personality either to compete and to deal with people all the time. What I really did enjoy was working in the field
mm-hmm.
and learning about nature and understanding evolution and ecology. It just really was something that turned me on and became a passion, and I still
mm-hmm.
love it. Still love talking about it and still love trying to do something in it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, great. Do you want to talk at all about atmosphere for women at UCLA? Did you notice whether male students were treated differently than females?
Mm-hmm.
Anything like that?
Yeah, there were. I actually did. I went into a graduate program subsequent to graduating from UCLA, and I was in it for 3 years and didn't attain anything. I was Martin Cody actually said he was no longer interested in the work I was doing.
So you were enrolled as mm-hmm. his graduate student?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Look, I felt awful for years and years and years, and really blamed myself for not being able to succeed. But then I've been looking back at that in terms of gender issues, and it turns out that in a program where there were probably 30 graduate students, there were only 4 women
mm-hmm.
and only 1 woman finished. And she was a little older than the rest of us, and she had a professional husband. And so he was able, I think, to give her counsel on how to deal with some of the issues. While in graduate school, it was clear that women were treated differently. Although I was still working in Frank Krasny's lab, I wanted to move into a teaching assistant position because it would be more in my field, and I would be participating and interacting and networking with people in the department. And when I went to the individual in charge of giving out TA-ships, he claimed that men with spouses had much more reason to have those jobs, and that those jobs are hard to come by, and that I was likely not to get it. I did get the position. And at the time, I did get a teaching position, which, and I'll talk about the way women were treated there in a minute.
Can I just interrupt for just a second? So you were enrolled as a graduate student in which department then?
Zoology.
Uh-huh. Okay, and your major advisor was?
Martin Cody.
Okay, uh-huh. and then you were applying for a teaching assistantship in zoology.
In zoology.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. I'm sorry about that.
No.
Yeah. I was a very, very quiet and submissive and meek individual. It was really hard for me to talk. And when Martin Cody never went and advocated for me in terms of, getting money, or at least I don't know that he did. When I did talk to this individual who was in charge of giving out the TA ships, I remember standing at his door, not even feeling as if I could go in, and just asking him if it were ever possible for me to get a TA ship. And he gave me this spiel about how the male graduate students mm-hmm. are supporting their spouses, etc. And I think I may have said, well, you know, I don't have a spouse that supports me, I'm supporting myself, mm-hmm. and I need more hours, and I can't get it in my current job. I did get a teaching assistantship, but I heard later that this individual made a comment about how aggressive I was. And my recollection of the whole scene is that I was so afraid of going into, you know, of bothering him mm-hmm. and, you know, pleading my case. And I was just trying to say, you know, it doesn't make sense to me, although I wasn't clear about it. But I did point out that I had to support myself, and I didn't have a spouse that could do that mm-hmm. for me, so I was on my own. When I finally did get a teaching assistantship, it was in the biology course, and I had taken the biology course as an undergraduate, so I had gone through all the experiments. I was the only woman TA in there, and I remember this Professor George Bartholomew, who is a physiological ecologist and just an outstanding biologist, but he didn't like women. And he would get up and talk about the following week's experiments that we were going to be doing in the labs and how our discussions needed to cover certain points. And before we would go into the experiment, he would turn to me almost every time and say, "Now, Mara, do we have to go through this for you?" And I would go, "No, not at all," because I'd been through it. And then a couple of the other males would say, "Well, I don't understand what's going on. Would you show us?" But it was very clear that I was being treated differently. And as I said, looking back, I mean, I just felt awful about not making it through the program. But looking back, only one woman out of four did. Mm-hmm. And I think it was because of attitudes about women mm-hmm. and that, you know, they're just there to get an MRS and they're not worth anything. One of the women who didn't make it actually went on and went into medical school in Seattle and became a physician. And the woman who did make it through actually got a job in Colorado. And the last thing I heard was that she was having a real rough time with getting tenure, and that she sued, and I think she got it. But I think that the attitudes concerning women professionals were really, really very negative. Mm-hmm. At the time, I was fairly naive about women issues. I remember that the women's movement was beginning to gain momentum, and that women were talking more about women rights. But at the time, I was still curling my hair every night and wearing dresses most of the time, except when I went into the field, mm-hmm. and you know, trying to be very feminine. Mm-hmm. And there were differences in terms of how we were treated and how much support we got.
How about the other the male graduate students? How did they treat you?
I have a really good friend that I met in our undergraduate course, and we both became Martin Cody's graduate students. Mm-hmm. I applied to work with Martin Cody, as did Terry, and when I showed up in Martin's office as one of his graduate students, he seemed surprised. "Oh, are you one of my graduate students?" You know, so I always felt out of it. But
I'm sorry, who seemed surprised?
Martin Cody. "Oh, are you going to work with me?"
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And
okay.
It was like, yes, I had applied. I thought I was accepted. But Terry and I are still good friends. Terry dropped out a year after he started, feeling that he could not support his family, and that going after a PhD was not what he wanted. He actually got a job with the Forest Service subsequent to this and adopted children. He's now working with BLM and has done remarkably well in terms of doing the kinds of things that he likes doing, and that, you know, making policy decisions about range management, or trying to get areas set aside for biological research. And that leads me into a situation with the Forest Service where Terry was working in the Sequoia National Forest Service office in just north of Los Angeles, and I forget the name of the town. And he wanted to set us most of the, our large part of the Sierras, the Southern Sierras, and then there are two mountains that are separated from the National Forest. One is the Greenhorns and the other is the Scotties. The Scotties is in the rain shadow of the Greenhorns, so it's fairly xeric compared to the Greenhorns. And but there's still, at the very top of the Scotties, is this remnant of old growth forest. And Terry wanted to have a wildlife survey done of it over the summer so that he could propose it as a biological study area, because there weren't many deer on the mountain and the Forest Service didn't feel that it was a good area for deer. And there wasn't anything to log. The little area of woodland, old growth woodland, was not big enough to bring in big trucks and things like that. So Terry asked me if I would be interested. This was at the end of my graduate work, or when I was told it was the end of my graduate work, and I was looking for something to do. And I said yes, and I he said, okay, well, here's an application, apply for the job. And I got a letter back from the personnel director at the Forest Service saying, well, these jobs are taking up, you know, in the fall of the previous year, and there just isn't any other job, et cetera, and you have to apply, you know, at the beginning of the fall for something, to do something the following summer, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought that was kind of funny, because Terry said he had just gotten the money and just set it up. So I called him, and he said he'd never seen my application. And he went to the personnel director, and the guy said, well, I didn't know you wanted to hire a woman. And so Terry said, told me to send him my application directly. He hired me, and the Forest Service, I was going into the field for most of the week, and the Forest Service felt that I needed an assistant. And the first assistant they chose for me was an individual in the Navy who was from that area, and he was on a work program to help him move from the services into a job. And so even though he was still associated with the Navy, he was on sort of an internship. But he was also notorious for being a ladies' man. And so everyone's kind of snickering under their hand at the idea of me spending, you know, 3 or 4 weeks in the field alone with this guy. The work was really interesting. It was extremely interesting. I did run into a few problems with person in who was supposed to be in charge of me in Kernville, saw me leave late midday Mondays and come out early afternoon Fridays, and said I wasn't working long enough. And yet the individual who's my assistant pointed out that I worked 12, 14 hour days when I was in the field. I mean, so.
So you were going into this area that he wanted to set aside as wilderness, and you were in the field for 5 days.
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
and what were you doing?
What we would do is get up and survey the birds and the plants, and we put out some traps for live traps for small mammals to see what was in the area.
Uh-huh.
And so it happened to be one of the greatest times in my field experience, because a lot of birds were migrating through in the mid to late summer, and because this was old growth forest, I was seeing birds that are considered fairly rare now,
mm-hmm.
Because they are associated with that little remnant of forest. And so I saw you know, species together that no one sees together, and
mm-hmm.
I saw a white-headed woodpecker, which was fairly rare, and but didn't appreciate it at the time as much, although I really enjoyed what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
That was a 6-week project, and then I moved up to Berkeley after
okay.
that.
Before we go on to mm-hmm. your Berkeley experience, you wanted to talk mm-hmm. about some trips to Mexico you took mm-hmm. while you were working for Martin Cady. Cody. Can you just, I don't think you've said yet what your project was under him, or what were you studying?
Okay. Well, I was interested in how communities are structured, so it's
uh-huh.
community ecology.
Okay.
And what I was studying was successional areas in the chaparral, in the, they're the little mountain range above Malibu.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, they weren't as developed as they are mm-hmm. now. And chaparral was really a common habitat type. So what I did was I set up 3 or 4 sites in the area, and I would go out and census the birds, and then I would also census the vegetation by counting the number of contacts on a stick. So I'd have a vertical pole that I would set down, and then I had a 4-foot horizontal pole that I would place at certain heights above the ground, and then I would count all the contacts on that horizontal pole, and I would do this at 20 different points in the area, and using that information I could get I could feed those data into getting a foliage height diversity for the area, so I could compare my areas in terms of foliage height diversity or structural diversity. And there was one area that hadn't, the chaparral is evolved so that it burns on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
There are shrubs that have oils in them that enhance mm-hmm. fires when they do occur,
mm-hmm.
and most of the plant species there are evolved for burning. But there was one area that hadn't been burned for 30 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of my endpoints. And then there had been an area that had been burned the year before next to it. And so I was able to do comparisons at those two areas. The recently burned area was just wonderful because it had 12-foot high mustard with big purple phacelia flowers, going through it. So I was in this forest of yellow and purple,
mm-hmm.
and seeing these birds, and it was lovely. But the project I was looking at is, how do species pack into communities?
Mm-hmm.
And is there something about the structure of the habitat that changes the different levels of species packing? For example, do you reach thresholds? When you first have an early successional community, you usually have species of birds that are ground feeders. Then when the structure gets a little more diverse, and you add in species that will feed through the shrubbery,
mm-hmm.
and then you'll eventually add in flycatchers and hawks and species that are more aerial.
Mm-hmm.
The question is that we were trying to get at is there a threshold where the structure of the habitat above a certain level will attract birds that feed above that level? Are, is there just a continuity of birds packing in, mm-hmm. where you have ground feeders that are also feeding at higher levels if available to them?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's probably the latter, that you have this continuity and you have to reach a certain structure. I didn't get enough data. I only had about five different sites of different successional times to look at, but it looked like species diversity increased and then sort of plateaued off within these sites. I was also collecting insect data, doing sweep net samples and trying to get some idea of the diversity of insects
mm-hmm.
in the habitat. So it was a remarkable way to spend your day, especially in the spring when there's so many different flowers. And it was, I think it would have been a very interesting project. But at the time, I didn't have the support, and I am extremely naive, and I didn't have the focus I needed. Mm-hmm. I had emotional problems that were sort of pulling me back, and I was spending so much of my energy just trying to feel okay about what I was doing. And one of the graduate students, after hearing that Cody had let me go, said, you know, you're very, very smart. The problem was you never talked about your data. And I realized, yeah, that was the problem, mm-hmm. is that I wasn't thinking and working with the data all the time, and it wasn't consuming me as it should have been, I think, to have gotten the project done and to have done a good job even without Cody's influence
mm-hmm.
or support. So.
So do you want to talk about the trips to Mexico?
Yeah, during my first year as a graduate student, I was taking Mildred Mathias's course on plants, and I met a graduate student there, and he had a friend who wanted to go collect bromeliads and orchids in Mexico, and he had one of these little VW buses, and unfortunately, we ended up having five valve jobs on the trip. It cost us, instead of costing us just a few hundred dollars to go down there and come back, there was major engine problems, and I was the translator. So when I got back from the trip, I was able to tell you how to fix the VW engine in both English and Spanish, never having actually seen it, but having talked to people about it. And that was really unfortunate because there was such a bad taste in one of the fellows' mouth about the whole situation. It did bother me that we were having car problems, but I felt safe in traveling in Mexico with two fellows who were interested in the same things I was, and we traveled to Oaxaca and then over to this little Puerto Escondido, which was this little town whose only way of getting gas was siphoning at, or pouring it out with a measuring cup from a big barrel.
Wow.
We had some really wonderful experiences that included hitchhiking to Acapulco to get parts for the car that had died in Puerto Escondido. And so I had a dual feeling about the trip. I was upset that we were having car troubles, but I really enjoyed the experience of seeing southern Mexico, of mm-hmm. camping out, of seeing things that we hadn't seen, whereas the individual who owned the car was just getting more and more uptight about the whole thing, and he was really angry and stopped talking to me after we got back. He was mad that I wasn't so upset. So, there's sort of an unusual thing, because it really did. I came back with a sense that, there was something wrong with me, and it put me in a depression for a long time. But I also look back on that experience as an experience that I wouldn't have had any other way, and it was just a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
couple of years later, several of my graduate student colleagues and I decided that we wanted to go down and record some bird songs that Cody, Martin Cody and Jim Brown had done research on, and it had to do with competitive exclusion. There were three species of birds found in this area in Oaxaca where two had the same song and two had similar plumages. And Cody and Brown, in a four-day trip, decided and reported in a publication that all these three species were interspecifically territorial. Their territories didn't overlap any more than you would expect overlap between individuals of the same species when they're setting up territory. So here was a wonderful example of character convergence, but they hadn't recorded the songs, and so there were several people that said, you know, oh, you can't believe them because they're not showing, you know, character convergence. So in vocalization, so we went down. There were four of us that went down and wanted to record the song, and we borrowed my stepfather's VW bus that he had bought in Germany. My stepfather's. He had bought in Germany on a trip to Europe, and he had had so much trouble trying to get it shipped over because there was a dock strike, and mm-hmm. It took him months and months and months. He finally got it, and he agreed to lend it to us. He kisses it goodbye as we're driving off, and he never saw it again, actually. We got to Oaxaca. We got up to the places where the birds were singing. We heard the birds. They went out, two of the people went out, you know, with a tape recorder to record them, and realized the batteries were dead. Someone had accidentally kicked the button on, so the batteries were drained. So we decided to go to Oaxaca and recharge the batteries, and because I had been there before and seen some of the sites, I decided to stay in the hotel with the tape recorder, and the other three took the car to go see the sites, and they were in a major accident. Mm-hmm. The driver of the car was hospitalized because he had a cracked vertebrae. The car was totaled, and it took us weeks to extract ourselves from the situation. Me being the only person who spoke Spanish at that time, and and it took months afterwards to get the insurance company to repay my stepfather. And as I said, he gave it the kiss of death, I guess. He never saw it again. But I think those two trips helped me see some things, but they also were very difficult emotionally and financially. I mean, it cost a lot to do that sort of thing. So when Cody told me that he was no longer interested in my research, and partly because I wasn't talking about it, I had just gone into him to propose doing another project on the side. I had just come out of the depression that I had been in and had a new lease on life, and decided that I would continue my studies on the chaparral communities, but in the downtime during the winter time, because this was breeding birds in spring, during downtime, I thought I could be doing something else. Mm-hmm. And so I had gone in there to make this proposal, and he said, "Well, I'm no longer interested in your work, and I think you need to just wrap it up and write it up." And it was just before I was giving a lecture for his ecology course, and I was so stunned. I have no idea what I said or how I said it. And I went into a really deep depression then, thinking that I had failed in the sense that I hadn't focused as much of my energies and resources on my work, but I was struggling with issues, both within me and I think partly within the structure of the system. There were There was only one woman in the department. I never met her. Mm-hmm. I had heard that they wouldn't hire any more women because she was such a bitch. And recently I've been looking at the website from UCLA, and they've reorganized the departments into specializations, but you still don't see, you see one woman per 12 men, you know, on the faculty. So there still hasn't been a move to incorporate more women, mm-hmm. although more women are interested in the fields. Mm-hmm. And having sat in some wildlife ecology courses, there are more women taking them than men.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not incorporated into the structure afterwards.
Right. Okay. Pause for a sec. Okay, so after you were told by Cody that he no longer wanted you working for him, and then you did the Forest Service mm-hmm. work for about 6 weeks, then you moved up to Berkeley, is mm-hmm. that right? Okay. Do you want to start with your work as a research associate at the UC Lawrence Berkeley lab, or?
Well, actually, when I moved to Berkeley, I moved in 1972, and it took me about 3 years to finally get a job. I worked as a podiatry assistant, and I worked as a dental assistant, and now I'm a specialist in foot and mouth diseases. As a result of that, I did some other jobs that I can't think of, short-term jobs, but it was really hard trying to get back on my feet because I was trying to write up my research without any kind of input and not really understanding stuff, although I did get it written up to a point where I was able to present it several years later at Berkeley.
So you didn't publish it then?
No, it's not published.
Okay.
And it probably isn't publishable because there weren't enough sites or years of study. I think mm-hmm. I needed to have studied it a year or two more and increase the number of points. But it had some interesting trends, I think, none of which I remember now. But I think that there were trends in terms of insect abundance and diversity of habitat and diversity, bird species diversity, mm-hmm. And just straightforward stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that my sense of community packing is that it's a gradual kind of thing and that there aren't necessarily thresholds of vegetational structure that bring in more species. Mm-hmm. That the species, at least with the birds in chaparral, are more general, and they may be ground foragers, but they can also you know, some of the species like the brown towhees and the wren tits do well in different structures, including urban structures in chaparral and in whatever. So they were fairly common. My general gestalt is that habitat structure in chaparral, which probably doesn't exist very much at all these days, habitat structure or a species packing is a gradual kind mm-hmm, of thing, mm-hmm. that some species are generalist, and you may bring in the specialist towards the end, but mm-hmm. most of the species early on are generalist.
So why did you choose to go to Berkeley?
I needed to get away from UCLA. Uh-huh. I needed to, my parents lived near Pasadena, and I just needed something that I felt was a little more, that would get me away and allow me to start afresh. I also, one of the people that I had traveled to Mexico with had done his undergraduate at Berkeley, and he just loved it, and he talked about it all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I felt there was a kinship there, and I had visited Berkeley a couple of times and really liked it. So I went to Berkeley. I had problems getting started in research. I was having these, you know, little jobs where.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was that I had been a nanny as an undergraduate with a family that had moved to Marin County, And so I had that contact up there because I was really close to that family. And I felt that there would, you know, that I could sort of make Berkeley my home, or at least become part of it. So it took me about 3 years to get a research position, and I got it as a result of having taken a course in immunology, and I met the individual who is principal investigator for this particular lab. He was looking for someone. I got the job. He left almost immediately for another job, but I stayed on in that lab for 4 years.
And that was the UC Lawrence Berkeley lab?
Right. Okay. And what they were doing was heavy ion radiation biology. So it was totally different from what I had been trained in, but they needed a tech, and most of it was handling mice and rats and putting them in front of beams. The purpose of the program, and it's no longer in existence, but what they were doing was they were wanting to develop heavy ion radiation to replace radiation. Because with heavy ion radiation, with radiation, as the beam goes in towards the target, let's say you've got a tumor in the middle of your head, there's more damage to the normal tissue than there is to the tumor. With heavy ion radiation, you can focus the beam so that the maximum damage is in the tumor, and there's a relative minimum damage to the normal tissue. So they were looking at relative biological effects. Is the tumor, or is the normal tissue, the target tissue, being damaged more than the normal tissue it's going through? And they were looking at things like carbon and oxygen and neon. And it turns out that neon, carbon, for example, had the same relative biological effect, or RBEs. Carbon, however, had more secondary particles. So its damage, there was more variation in its effect versus neon. And what was really interesting was that my supervisor, who actually didn't have a degree, I think, but she had worked her way into this position, didn't understand statistics. And so when she was analyzing the data and she saw variation, she thought it was because of sloppy technique. And she tried eliminating that variation. And I remember having this discussion with her and a graduate student, and we were both trying to point out that it was that the variation in the system was extremely important. Because if you've got a tumor in the middle of your head and you want to shoot a beam into it, you want a beam that isn't dirty, like carbon. You'd prefer the neon. And so she needed to keep the variation in the data so that when they're comparing, you know, two heavy ion radiation effects, that they get the better and not think that, you know, both are equivalent. And this was something that she couldn't comprehend, and it was just, it was extraordinary because the PI on the program wasn't concerned about it either. The heavy ion, this was with the Bevatron at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. It was a very, it was the only thing, only Bevatron in the world, and basically there was a linear accelerator that started at the top of the Berkeley Hills and got the heavy ions started. You know, so they had to get them pumped up.
Right.
And then there were all these magnets that fed the heavy ions into a cyclotron. And the cyclotron was used to get the radiation dose at a level where someone didn't have to sit there for 2 years to get an effective dose. So the cyclotron was used to speed up the radiation dose. When they turned and the whole complex was called Bevatron. When they turned the Bevatron on, the lights in Berkeley would dim, you know, and then come up. And they figured, I think it was $2,000 an hour to run the Bevatron, and it was only 50% efficient. I mean, it would break down all the time. And so we would go in there whenever they had a run. They might say, okay, you'll be in there at noon. And we might not get in there until midnight or 4 o'clock in the morning. So we had to be ready and willing to get up and go at any time during these runs to do the experiments. And that was the first time in my life I had ever worked or been up past about 10 or 11 o'clock. Most of the time I just fell asleep. In college, I would go to bed early rather than studying because sleep was so important. So I learned to kind of change my habits then.
So you were there, you said, for about 4 years?
I was there from 1975 to 1980, and during that time, I decided that I wanted to go back. I had this hanging, or the sense of a hanging, unfinished thesis. And I decided that it would be promotionally beneficial for me if I had a master's, that I might get a better job or whatever, and that it would help me in the long run. So, and there was my supervisor was able to go back and get her bachelor's degree while she was working, and I thought, well, why not? Why don't I do that? And because I had had credits at UCLA in ecology and evolution, because that was my passion, I went back and asked the zoology department there if I could do a master's program. And they hadn't done master's programs before. And I told them that I would have to work full time so that I couldn't really do a research project. I'd have to do it by exam. And they decided to try it, let me do it. And effectively, several other people after me came in and did the same thing.
So this is a program where you took classes and there was no thesis project.
Right. Okay. It was supposed to be a terminal degree because what I was using.
Okay, this is tape two of Madeline Fisher's interview with Dr. Mara McDonald, and today is January 17th, 2004. So when the last tape ended, you were talking about completing your master's degree, which was a terminal degree, but you wanted to back up for a second and talk about a project you did at Point Reyes where you learned about bird banding.
Right. Berkeley's a great area to learn about nature because it has so many, it has access to Point Reyes Peninsula, and it also has, San Francisco is where the Sierra Club initially started in the late turn of the century, between the 19th and 20th, and it was started by John Muir, and there's a tradition of conservation in that area. As a matter of fact, backing up to UCLA, we had the first Earth Day in 1970, where I got involved with some of the people from the first trip I took to Mexico. And there was just an overwhelming sense that the conservationists and the environmentalists were going to move forward and that the agenda was going to take over the country, because things were happening all across the U.S. and it was just so uplifting and so positive. Shortly after, this was April 22nd, on May 4th with Kent State massacres, and the country went into this anti-war doldrum that really changed the thinking, I think, of most people, going from being very uplifted and positive to being very critical of our government and not trusting what was going on, and not accepting authority anymore. I think that was the turn in our culture in this nation, was when that happened, especially when our own soldiers kill students who are and there were four of them that died, I think. Our own soldiers killed students for practicing free speech and their right to free speech, and that was just awful, and it still is. But anyway, while I was at while I was in Berkeley, I wanted to continue doing work in the field, and so I contacted Bob Stewart, who is the field or the land bird biologist at the Point Reyes Bird Observatory. And this was in the early days of the observatory. There is a small group of people who were very, very close with one another, and the families interacted all the time. It was very tightly knit. Well, Bob was interested in character displacement, again, similar to the character displacement work we did in Mexico. But he noticed that there were two species of kinglets, the ruby crown and the golden crown kinglets, that overwintered on the Point Reyes Peninsula. And they're very, very similar, the same size. They're almost difficult to tell apart, except for a couple of characters. And the question is, how could two similar species coexist at the same time, in the same place, without one or both going to exist to extinction? And this was sort of the rule in ecology, is that, you know, no two species, no similar species can coexist at the same time and place. So Bob asked this question, and what we did was we went to three different habitats, and we looked at tall bishop pine, sort of medium height alder habitat, and short mixed oak woodland. And in the tall bishop pine, what we found is that the golden crown kinglets fed in flocks, mixed species flocks, at the very tops of the trees. And the ruby crown kinglets usually set up territories in the shrubbery at the bottom of the trees. And they would move through their territories with other species, but then they would come to sort of the demarcation, whatever it was, and then they'd move back. So in tall bishop pine, the two species were dividing the habitat vertically. In alder, not much was going on, and I think it was because we didn't see many kinglets, and I think part of it might have had to do with the quality of the food. It also might have been in terms of whether there was a resource to divide, although you would expect one or the other species to be there, and they weren't. So I think it was the quality of food. Short oak woodland, there was no vertical height to divide, so the way the two species divided the habitat was ruby crowns fed on the outside of the trees, golden crowns fed closer to the trunk of the trees, and they divided the habitat horizontally. Which, and so they coexisted. I mean, it was just a really wonderful little piece of work that Bob actually did. I did some other kinds of measurements on foraging behavior and ecology, but I think that the result was we did have character displacement on resources, and that the character displacement was flexible to the resource available. Several years later, when I had finished my master's in zoology, I went back, and there had been a change in administration, and I worked with the bird banding program there and learned how to band birds and what kinds of information was necessary when you were taking them out of the net and measuring them, and how to handle them and how to identify them and eventually how to age them. So this was at the early stages of bird banding. Now it's become, even though bird banding has been going on for over 100 years, and they've been collecting data on birds, over a million birds are banded each year, and about 60,000 are recaptures. So, you know, there are there's all kinds of information out there every year on the biology of birds, where they go, how long they live, where they live, etc. There's and a lot of this information is used for conservation purposes as well as management purposes. But this Point Reyes work was in the early part of its inception, and also in the earlier part when banding stations were rare. Now in Wisconsin, I know of several people who have banding stations, and they're not as intense or as big as the Point Reyes, which is, has just broadened and become really a top-notch research area. But the banding stations are out there, and there are people who are doing, you know, who are gathering little bits of information on birds.
So then after you finished your master's, you decided to pursue a PhD at, University of Florida, Gainesville. Mm-hmm. And so what? Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, the coursework and the seminars and the intellectual stimulation were just so intense at Berkeley that going back to radiation biology and shooting heavy ion beams at mouse testes or whatever was not exciting to me. And I couldn't see staying there and doing that work. What I really wanted to do was to continue in evolution and ecology because it really excited me, mm-hmm. really grabbed my attention, and I just felt passionate about doing the work. So I decided about halfway through my master's program that I would go on for a PhD. I talked to an individual at Berkeley who had a number of graduate students who had expressed interest in my thinking because I'd taken several exams and I'd actually presented my work from UCLA in a seminar, and he was very excited about that. And he said he would consider taking me as a graduate student, although he had never taken a woman before. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he called me up at one point and said that the department wouldn't let him take on anyone else. And I think that was true on his part, although I think that there was a certain angst with him about taking on a woman graduate student as well. Although his wife was a professor in the department. So there was a dual sense that maybe it was my gender that contributed to his decision. Or maybe it had nothing to do with my gender, maybe it was the fact that he had too many graduate students. Mm-hmm. He was so funny because he didn't remember names very well, and he would start to list off a couple of the people, and then he'd call, and then he'd say, "And the rest of my flock." So he, I think that contributed to his not being able to take me on. So I did get accepted at the University of Florida, Gainesville, and I had applied there because Peter Feinsinger was doing work on hummingbirds and community ecology, and I would have loved to work with hummingbirds, and I was into community ecology. My training was in that area, and I thought that would be great. So I went to Gainesville. I told Peter that I wanted to wait a couple of years between my master's and starting my PhD program because I wanted to work and get some money saved away. Uh-huh. I didn't think it would be good for me to hop into a PhD program. And he said that was fine, that his grant wouldn't be starting for a couple of years, and then I could, you know, move right into it. Well, when I finally got to Gainesville and actually got in touch with him before I got there, he said he had given the project over to two other students who had already gone, or one other student who had already gone and gotten through the program at Gainesville, had got all their coursework done, and they were now in Costa Rica.
And this was after you got to Florida?
No, actually it was just shortly before. Okay. I contacted him and I said, you know, I'm ready, and he said, oh, by the way, and at that point, I had decided to go back to get my PhD. I decided that there was might be a chance I could go to Costa Rica to do work on the hummingbirds or to do something else. And I wanted to get back into a PhD program. And the one at Berkeley wasn't going to work out, and I had one or two other applications out there that I hadn't really pursued very intensely. So I felt that this was the best place for me to go.
So the department had accepted you, and but then you no longer had a project to work on.
Right.
Okay.
But Peter said, you know, there's so much you can do, you know, and there's a chance you can go to Costa Rica.
Okay.
And my, you know, one of my major interests was to go to the tropics to work on some of these problems. And there had been a program at UCLA called let's see, it still is in existence, but it sends students down for 6 weeks or so to study the ecology of Costa Rica fairly intensely, and they go to different habitats and do different projects, etc. And I can't think of the name right now. I had applied when I was at UCLA. I didn't get in. And when I was at Florida, I reapplied, and I was told I didn't get in because at that point it looked like I was going to do a research project on Florida birds, breeding birds. Well, it turns out that Florida was not a great habitat, and in the summer it was just awful. It was really sweaty and hot, and I didn't appreciate it. I think I appreciate it a little more now, but I did go to Florida. I did get exposed to conservation biology. There are several people like Lincoln Brower, who does work on, who is famous for his work on monarch butterflies. Larry Harris, who wrote a book on the fragmented forest and incorporated some models of island biogeography into management and wildlife ecology and conservation. And these models have, conservation biology actually started about 1982. I think that was the beginning, you know, the official beginning of mm-hmm. conservation biology. There was another individual there, John Robinson, who has since moved to an administrative position, I think, in the World Wildlife Organization or, mm-hmm. or some sort of conservation, major conservation group. So there was this sense that conservation and wildlife ecology was really important, and that it integrated community ecology models. And it was just a real easy step. And so I sat in on a lot of the courses. I didn't take them. I sat in on them. Because at the time, even though I was interested in conservation biology, I had to make up some other requirements. And it turns out that although at Berkeley, when I took prescriptive exams there, I was one of the top people in my group for coming out. At Florida, I failed 3 out of 4 exams. And I later realized that at Florida, to get a PhD, if you went in with a master's, took an average of 8 years. And I had gone into the program thinking I could be out in 4 or 5 years. And so what they did, essentially, was they created cannon fodder for the courses.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they created these exams so that people coming in had to take the courses mm-hmm. in order to make up for their failing the exam.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I was really surprised I failed the genetics part, and I went to look at my exam, and there wasn't a mark on it. And I asked, what did I do wrong? I thought I did, you know, I felt really good about this exam. And the person showing me said, well, you'll have to ask the people who graded it, and evidently they had a conflict and they were trying to outdo the other person and failing people. And I thought, here I am at the very beginning of my career in the zoology department, and I'm not going to challenge anyone. I'll just leave it. So I did, unfortunately, because I think it was a total waste of time take some of those courses.
So let me just interrupt you for a second. So you went to Florida, this Peter Feinsinger, was he then going to be your advisor? So you had an advisor, but you had no project yet.
Well, he wanted me to do land bird, breeding birds in Florida. Rather than going down to Costa Rica.
I see.
And so I was trying to figure out how to go to the tropics.
I see.
And I reapplied for this tropical biology program, and I wasn't accepted because my work wasn't going to be in the tropics.
Okay.
As part of the conservation coursework, I met an individual who's doing work in Haiti, and I managed to... Peter Feinsinger was not really thrilled about my work, and I was not thrilled about my project. I mean, I was falling asleep instead of, you know, writing out my proposal. It just was not something I was interested in. But Peter Feinsinger was kind of lackadaisical, and he took off a year to go to Costa Rica. And during that period, I met this individual who had a project in Haiti, and I started talking to him about it, and I started talking about discussing some birds that were very common, but it was unclear what their systematics was. And it was an evolutionary project, and I went to the Smithsonian for a couple of weeks to check their collection and measure it and look at it. And I decided to switch projects about 2 weeks before my oral exams.
For your oral exams for your...
For the PhD.
To get permission or to start on your actual thesis.
Exactly.
Work. Okay.
Exactly. And so my committee was composed mostly of ecologists. And here I had decided to switch to an evolutionary biology systematics focus. And so, you know, it was kind of funny going into the oral exam talking about ecology when, you know, evolution was really my passion. And so, I got past it. It was a very long exam.
Can I clarify?
Yeah.
So, when switching this project, were you then still staying with Peter Feinsinger, or were you moving on to another advisor?
At one point, he was going to co-advise with this other person, Charles Woods, and it became clear that Peter was growing more and more uncomfortable with my project because I was moving away from basically community structuring. And so at one point, I just said, you know, would you like to... bow out? And he said yes, because he was about ready. He was focusing on his work in Costa Rica on hummingbirds, and he was not too thrilled about what I was interested in, and it just seemed appropriate. And it was a perfectly good situation. He was no longer appropriate for my project, and I gave him an out. The co-chair, I had co-chairs for some reason. The co-chair of my committee, even though he was an ecologist and interested in insect ecology, said he would stay on and support me through whatever I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm still in contact with that man. Mm-hmm. He's recently retired, but I find him, I really appreciate the fact that he was going to stick with me through thick or thin. Mm-hmm. Whereas Peter was kind of wishy-washy, not really very focused. Anyway, I decided to change my project to the systematics of palm tanagers. And I had had a lecture in evolution at Berkeley on heterochrony, which is developmental timing events. So genes are turned on at certain points in our development, and they are regulated, and if you have a mutation in the regulation of that gene, then that gene may turn on earlier or later, and the function of that gene then may impact on the way development goes. So one of the big questions in evolution at the time was whether, you know, how fast could evolution occur. And up to that point, the tempo and mode of evolution was thought to be long and gradual. And Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge wrote a book on punctuated equilibria, where they said, in the fossil record, you see gaps in the in that area, and it's not because of poor fossilization. It's because very rapid evolution is probably occurring, and that what you have are long periods of stasis, and then a punctuated, you know, evolutionary period where something happens in the environment, and it's strong, it has strong selection, so that the populations within that environment start to change very rapidly.
Right.
And the question was, well, how can you get rapid evolution? And the answer is, you just change regulatory genes. You don't have to evolve a brand new gene for a brand new function that has to be selected for an adaptive mechanism. What you can do is either slow down or stop or change the timing of development. And for example, humans resemble infant apes. And at the time, for a long period before that, the question is, what is the adaptive value of hairlessness in humans? And the answer through using the model of heterochrony is there is no adaptive value. We've just retained the features of the infant ape, which is basically hairless. I mean, we're sort of like the infant ape, and then we've gone on and done other things. And the consequence of hairlessness is that there were certain characters that were selected for on us, and hairlessness happened to be a character that sort of went along with the selection of the other suite of characters. So I felt that this was an extremely interesting area, and I had been turned on to it at Berkeley in that one lecture. And when I looked at the, when I was talking to Woods about the project on the two birds, I saw that, first of all, I would be working on birds. Secondly, I would be in a tropical area. And thirdly, whatever I decided to do with species was going to be a dissertation project, because little was known about the birds. So, you know, it was a win-win situation, as far as I could tell. And when I went to the Smithsonian, I realized that there was a dimorphism in one of the species that was found over most of Hispaniola, the island. And it wasn't associated with sexual dimorphism. It looked like an age dimorphism. And the other species was often confused with the juveniles of the first species. So it looked like the other species might have been evolved through a heterochronic event. And it occurred on a part of the island, which is a peninsula, which had been divided or separated from the main part of the island during the Pleistocene, when glaciers melted, sea levels rose, and there were two islands. And so I used that as a focus of my research. I was able to show, when I went to Haiti, that that there was an age dimorphism, not only morphologically in one of the species, but genetically and behaviorally. And that the species that was derived from this antecedent resembled the juveniles not only morphologically, but behaviorally. They'd retained juvenile behaviors in foraging. And they could be derived using a model, an island colonization model composed of groups of birds composed mostly of juveniles. And there was literature saying that birds that were moving into new habitat or suboptimal habitat usually were composed mostly of juveniles. You shove the juveniles out, you've already got a lot of investment in the adults. So you let the juveniles go out and try new things, and if it works, great, and if it doesn't, you know, you haven't lost much. It's the same thing in macaque monkeys. It's the young that try new foods, not the mm-hmm. adults. And if the young survive trying the new food, then the adults may come along and try it. So it's you kind of shove the juveniles out. Well, it fit perfectly in this island colonization model. It fit perfectly in regulatory genome changes because the descendant species resembled the juvenile of the antecedent species, suggesting that it retained juvenile characters because it was in a habitat that had no competitors, and therefore it could breed earlier. And once an organism breeds, then it doesn't need to mature morphologically past that stage. As long as you're breeding, you know, that's what evolution is all about. So we had a really nice little system to suggest this. And it was interesting because Stephen Jay Gould had written his book on the models of heterochrony and had said on page 300 and something that this doesn't work for birds. Birds are not, you know, a system where you expect heterochrony. And yet I and two other women working on different systems found heterochrony in our birds, and I think that heterochrony is the major reason why birds are so diverse. Mm. So that they're able to evolve very quickly, and they're able to evolve and diversify into different habitats by changing regulatory genes.
Okay. Yeah. Let me pause here for a second.